This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
Of machlokes, if uniqueness and individuality is going to be encouraged, if people are going to be encouraged to utilize and to develop their own individual talents and gifts, obviously they're going to look at things in different ways, and machlokes is in fact essential and contributes to the richness of the world. However, we learned that machlokes can be restricted to the intellectual area of the Beis HaMedrash, and it only needs come out of the Beis HaMedrash. In other words, machlokes only begins to affect the way people relate to one another, rather than just the way they think with one another and talk to one another. It only begins to affect the honor and respect with which they treat one another when there's a personal inadequacy which is trying to be covered up. When the purpose of the machlokes is not to reach the truth, is not to reach and understand the emes, but the purpose of the machlokes is merely to show yourself or others that you're a little bit better than the guy next door you, then the machlokes is going to be dragged outside of the Beis HaMedrash. It's going to be dragged outside of the area of intellectual debate, and it's going to become it's going to become an aspect of interpersonal relationships, and that is never allowed as long as it's machlokes along the lines that we've discussed. In fact, that's what the Tosfos says. Tosfos asks that there's conflicting gemaras about whether if one can't learn lishmo, if one can't learn Torah lishmo, one can't learn it for the real true reasons, and one isn't learning correctly, is it better not to learn at all, or should one learn? So in some places the gemara says it's better not to learn at all, and in some places the gemara says it's better to learn, because by learning shelo lishmo mitoch shelo lishmo bo lishmo, ultimately you'll come to do it the right way around, and it's better to learn. Asks Tosfos, well, which is it? You've got a stira, there's a contradiction in the gemara. Answers Tosfos, it depends what you mean by lo lishmo. If it just means that you're learning because you want to feel good, you enjoy it, you want to become a rabbi or something like that, that's shelo lishmo, that's not the correct reason to learn. And if you're learning for one of those reasons, it's better to learn than not to learn, because there's nothing harmful about it, and ultimately something good might come out of it. But if you're learning to cover up an inadequacy, if you're learning in order to prove another guy wrong, if you're learning in order to show off that you're better than the other person, if you're learning is almanat lakanter, is to cause machlokes between people, then it's somehow malvis, it's poison for you and the society, and you're better off not learning at all. You and the society would be better off if you were an amoritz. And that's halacha, that's how we hold. We're going to examine a little bit further today the effects of trying to cover up inadequacies on interpersonal relationships, and what to do about it. The parsha we're dealing with is the parsha in Chukas, on the first of today's Sedras. This incredible story about the snakes, where the Torah tells us, "Vayisu mehor ahar derech yamsuf v'sbovet eretz Edom," and the Bnei Yisrael traveled from Hor Ahar, which was where Aaron died, towards Yamsuf, which is back the direction they've come from, the Red Sea. That's just where they've come from, 38 years before that, in fact. So as to navigate, I don't know what you would say, so as to pass Eretz Edom, not to go through the land of Edom, they've just been refused entry. Vatiktzar nefesh ha'am badarech, and the people became impatient on the way. Okay, I can understand that. They've been schlepping around for 38 years, and all of a sudden they find they're back where they started. They get impatient. So one would expect that their complaint is now going to be, we want to get to Israel already, what's going on? We're in a hurry. And the people talk against God and Moshe. Not nice, but one can understand it. What do they say? Why do you bring us out of Egypt to die in the desert? And who says they're going to die in the desert? They've been looked after very nicely for 38 years. Do they think that God's left them all of a sudden because they can't go through Edom? Ki ein lechem ve'ein mayim. So there's no bread and there's no water. What are they talking about? There's no bread and there's no water. They've just had the most incredible miracle done to them for water. They've had water for 38 years. They've had mon every day for 38 years. What are they worried about? And they answer that. V'nafshenu katzar b'lechem atlokel. You'll tell us that we've got mon. We're sick of mon. That's the translation. We're sick of it. We're not going to eat it anymore. And we're going to die here. very strange, what's wrong with Mona? Mona is the most wonderful food, and Chazal battled to try and find a way to tell us how tasty it really was, and you didn't have to prepare it, you just wished it to be whatever you wanted it to be, and that's how it came out to be, and it was healthy and everything was it. It's very difficult to understand what they're complaining about. Okay, someone would expect God to, and Moshe, to get upset and angry with him, which they do. But Vayishlach Hashem Baim et HaNechashim HaSrafim. So God sent the snakes in. Snakes got to do with it all of a sudden. Sent a whole lot of snakes in. Vayenashchu etam, and they start biting everyone. Vayamut Amrav miYisrael, a lot of Jews died as a result of this. What's going on? Vayavo HaAmel Moshe, and the people came to Moshe. Vayomru Chatanu, and they said, look, this is no good, can't live with these snakes, we've sinned. We understand that the Aveira we did was talking against you and Hashem, Hashem and you. Hitpalel Hashem, please pray to the Ribbono Shel Olam. V'yaser me'aleinu et hanachash, and let him take the nachash away from us. V'yitpalel Moshe be'ad ha'am, and Moshe prayed for the people. They haven't done tshuva yet, they didn't apologize. They said chatan, they've done vidu, but they haven't, there's been no charata yet, there's no, been no kabbalah l'haba, they haven't undertaken never to do it again. Pray for us. So if Moshe prays, and what happens? So under normal circumstances, one would expect God either to come along and say, look, no good yet, do a bit more tshuva, or not enough people have died yet, you haven't learned your lesson yet. Or one would expect God to remove the snakes. No way, we're in for a surprise here. By Yom HaShem Moshe, and God says to Moshe, Asay lecha saraf, make a snake, out of an artificial snake, besim oto on this, and stick it on a pole, vaya kol hanashuk v'ra'a tovachai, and anybody who's bitten looks at the snake, and he'll live. What is it? Vayas Moshe Nachash Nachoshet, and Moshe made a copper snake, Vayasimeyu al Nes, and he put it on a pillar, on a pole, Vayayim Nashach Nachashet Ish, and it was that if a snake bit a man, Vihi bit el Nachash Nachoshet, he took a look at the Nachash Nachoshet, Vachai, and he lived. It's a pasha, it's weird. Furthermore, Rashi asks, in the name of the Medrash, and our rabbi said, do you think that it's the snake, this artificial snake, which can make people live or die? Says the Midrash, now I'll tell you what it's all about. Now they're going to solve, the Midrash is going to solve the problem for us. When Bnei Yisrael are looking up to heaven, and they enslaved their hearts to the Ribbono Shel Olam who is in heaven, they were cured. And if they didn't, they died. Understand that. But what do you need a copper snake for? Why didn't you just tell everyone when you get bitten, look at the skies? Think of God. Do something. Say Kriya Shema. Where does this come from? Make a copper snake. So what? If you don't need the copper snake, which is what the Midrash is saying, don't think the copper snake did anything. It's just the fact that they looked up to heaven. They looked up to heaven. What do you need a copper snake for? It just doesn't make sense. So let's look at it. The Am Yisrael did two naughty things here. The first one was that they spoke against God and Moshe. That's the thing that they apologized, that they mentioned, they do vidui for. And the second thing is their denigration of the Mon. We're sick of this awful stuff. We don't want it anymore. Let's try and understand the connection between these two complaints of the Bnei Yisrael. What is it that they did? What was wrong with the Bnei Yisrael? What's bothering them? There's something that's eating them up. What is it? What's hurting them now? And to do that, we're going to start by analyzing their objection to the Mon. What was it that they didn't like about the Mon? And to do that, we have to understand a little bit more about the Mon. And to do that, we've got to go back to understanding things we've spoken about often before, and that is the two modes of existence. We've called it previously the qualitative mode of existence and the quantitative mode of existence. A human being can achieve fulfillment and satisfaction by quality and by quantity. There are two ways that a human being can fulfill himself. We live in the West, and that includes communism. Communism is no different. We live in a quantitative society. Some people call it an acquisitive society, a society where acquiring is important, possessing is important. A society where success is measured in terms of how much one has, stature is measured in terms of how much one has, one's own self-evaluation is in terms of how much one has, and where the ambition and most of our day goes into getting more. That's the society in which we live. In Torah society, in Hebrew, in fact, there is no word for possession. There is no word for I have. You say, yeshli. Yeshli means I have a relationship with. Something relates to me. Something is to me. In other words, in Torah, there is no such thing as possession altogether. We don't possess anything. All we do have are the rights to relate to things in certain ways which are limited and governed by the Torah. There's some things I can relate to almost unlimitedly. Almost. There's nothing I can relate to unlimitedly. But there are some things I can relate to almost unlimitedly, and some things I can relate to very limitedly. If I have a sefer, there's certain rules, there's certain halachas that govern how I can use that sefer, how I'm permitted to relate to that sefer. But I don't possess it. I can't throw it away. No, please, I'm giving the shir, okay? The second thing is, one can have a chayfetz which has less halachas that govern the use of that particular object. I can have a motor car. Still, with a motor car, I've got to be careful. There are certain things I can do and certain things I can't do. But the restrictions are less than the restrictions that would govern, for example, a sefer Torah. But all I'm entitled to do, ultimately, when you look at it and you analyze it, all I'm entitled to do really is to relate to the object. I'm entitled to use it in certain ways. I'm given the use of the object, but never the possession of the object. There are three things that people need very badly. We have a past, we have a present, and we have a future. And those three aspects of our existence have to be carefully catered to. That is, one has to feel that one's past has been worthwhile. If one feels one's past has been a waste of time, it causes major psychological problems in the present and spiritual problems. One has to feel that the future will be all right. Because if one's worried about the future, it causes major anxieties and major psychological and spiritual problems. And most important of all, one has to enjoy the present. Now that's quite difficult, but that's what we're all busy trying to aim for. Those three elements are necessary just to live a normal life. A person who's worried about the future, concerned about the past, or not enjoying the present, is a person who has psychological problems. He doesn't even come onto the point where he can start operating as a Jewish, in a Jewish way, in a Torah way. He's not even operating in a human way yet. Those are the first things that have to be looked after. A person has to be fulfilled in those three areas. As far as the past is concerned, the way we do it is through uniqueness. If I can feel that my past has made me different from everybody else, then I feel my past has been worthwhile, because it's got me to where I am. I might not be the best person, I might not be the greatest, I might not be the richest, but I'm different, I'm unique, I'm special. And that feeling is enough to make me feel satisfied with my past. So how do we do it in the Western acquisitive society? Simply, by buying things that nobody else has got. That's it, the latest models and the latest fashions and different things and different colours and my own taste. And the one buys, in some cities all the houses look the same. So they put different things on it, and they change the front door, and they change it inside, and they paint it all weird colors outside. But your house should not look the same as the one next door to it. It should look unique and different and special, so that you can feel a certain separateness and difference between yourself and the people around about you, which justifies the past. So you've been busy making yourself who you are today. That's the way we do it in Western society. We buy things which other people don't have. And that gives us a great deal of pleasure to have things which other people don't have. As far as the future is concerned, we invest. We collect money, and we work, and we slave, and we save, and we buy insurance policies. Nothing against insurance salesmen, you do a wonderful job. But that's how it is. In Western society, we need insurance agents to insure our possessions. What happens if we lose them? To insure our lives. What happens if we get lost ourselves? To insure our pensions. What happens when we retire and we get no more income? Always worried about the future, so we invest money. So we work much harder than we need to, to try and earn much more than we need, so as to pay for our future as well. Not only our present, but we're paying for our future as well. And it's our possessions which give us the sense of security. The more I have, the more secure I feel. Or I'm sure that if I would have more, I would feel more secure. That's really how it works. And then, as Tanakh told us, oh, if kesef lo yisba kesef, a person who's in love with money can never have enough. Because however much I've got, I'm always worried. What happens if I lose what I've got? If I have some more eggs in another basket, it's safer. Then you put more eggs in the other basket, and then again you start off. And what happens if the whole stock market goes to the dogs? So I better have something in property too, so I better work a little bit harder. And a bit of insurance here and a bit of insurance there, and one works and works and works, all for the future. So as to make sure that there should be no anxiety about the future. that only works in an acquisitive society where what's important is to have, because I'm not making plans as to how to spend my future. I'm not making plans to see that I'll be mature enough at retirement age to handle retirement. All I'm making sure is that I'll have enough goods, I'll have enough things to keep me going. What do we do about the present? The most amazing thing, as far as the present is concerned, we use a simple technique which we learn in early childhood. What do children do about the present? To enjoy the present, we need one element, and that's excitement. If there's no excitement, we're not operating to the best of our ability. When we're excited, our senses are sharp, our intellect is sharp, our mind is watching, we're observant, we notice things, we're quick, we're at our best when we're excited, and we enjoy it. We feel alive when we're excited. That's fine, that's how it should be. But how do we achieve excitement? How do kids achieve excitement? They take a little board with painted squares, 100 painted squares on it, and snakes and ladders on it, and a dice and two little buttons. And the thing is, who gets to the top first? And there's excitement, because you're moving all the time. It's a question of who gets there first. And the more important it is to get there, the more excitement there is. And when that excitement starts wearing off, when the kids get a little bit older, they start playing Monopoly. Another question is, who can accumulate the most money in the shortest period of time? And that's exciting. And when that doesn't get exciting enough, then they start gambling. And Harold, where are you? And they play with real money. And they watch that roulette wheel spinning. And at those moments, they're more alive than at any other time. At those moments, their sharpness of spirituality even, their mind, intellect and awareness and ability is so sharp. And they watch the thing, and they watch, and the wheel goes slower and slower. And they watch the ball falling, and it falls, and it is or it isn't. There's the moment of relaxation and the build-up for the next bit of excitement. But you can't do that all day. So we create another game, and we call that game business. Where again, the art of the game is to collect as much as possible, as quickly as possible, and to beat the guy next door. It's all a game. And the way we keep score is with real money. Right? And there have been books written about the money game. That's what it is. It's a game that big boys play. That's all. Because if we just wanted money to keep ourselves going, we would take a job, we would clean the streets, we would grow some tomatoes in our back garden, we would do what has to be done, but there's no excitement in that. The excitement is to build a business, and to build a better business than the guy next door, and a bigger business than the guy next door, and in fact to beat him right out of business, and to take over his business, him and his business's business, and so to move on and to acquire as much as possible and to win the game. That's how we achieve excitement. And then every day is excitement. One comes into one's office, all built up, and who's going to be the competition today, and how are we going to smash them, and what scheme are we going to dream up to beat the receiver of revenue and everybody else who are our bitter enemies, and so our life goes past in great excitement. How do we do it in the qualitative society? In the qualitative society, the past, uniqueness, it's necessary to experience uniqueness, but I experience my uniqueness not in what I've got. That's no uniqueness. I experience my uniqueness in what I am, in how I feel about things, in how I react to things, in how I'm able to think, how I'm able to analyze, how I'm able to perceive, how I'm able to put that perception into practice, how I'm able to interrelate with people. I'm different from anybody else. What's made me different? My past. It's my education. It's my background. It's my friends. It's my learning. It's my personality. It's my talents. That's made me what I am. One finds that uniqueness is much more difficult to achieve in a qualitative sense. In a quantitative sense, it's very simple. You just have to keep a step ahead of everybody else and buy something before everybody else has got it. And by the time other people have got it, there's something else out to buy. That's how people make money. That's why the fashion business and the motor car business can keep going, because people like to be unique. In the qualitative society, the lower down one is in the area of exerting, in the pyramid of exerting oneself, the less unique you are. If all I do, let's say, is sleep my 8 hours and eat my 3 meals and daven in the morning and go to work for my 8 or 9 hours a day and play golf once a week, if that's what I do, not much uniqueness. When I start exerting myself, I start becoming more unique. When I start getting to the top of my business, when I start learning 2 hours a day in addition to what I do, when I start davening with more kavana, then I start developing uniqueness and specialness. And the more and more I exert myself, the more am I able to express that uniqueness. For example, if a whole lot of people are running in a marathon, the people who run the first 100 yards, nobody's unique, because everybody does that. And the first mile, nobody's unique because everybody does that. It's the ones who get to the end that are unique. And it's the one who gets to the end first that's unique. Why? Because he's stretched himself. That's the area where you can test the uniqueness of people, when they're stretching themselves. When everybody's just operating on a sort of an average sort of efficiency and an average sort of energy, then he's an average sort of person. It's only when he's pushing himself to the limits of his talents, of his intellect, of his personality, of his ability, and he's using everything he's got, that he'll be producing actions and feelings which are different to what anybody else has done, because he is different. But that's hard. Very hard work. The future. Emunah. We've got Emunah in the Ribbono Shel Olam. We have a relationship with the Ribbono Shel Olam which removes anxiety regarding the future. Yes, sure, if one has funds, one's expected to invest them. And the Gemara gives one detailed plans of investment, how you invest excess funds. But we're not expected to work to accumulate excess funds. And this period of inflation has possibly come to teach us that very lesson, that it just doesn't pay to accumulate excess funds, because when you need them, they're not excess anymore. And so one goes spending one's whole life trying to work harder to get more at a later stage, which when you get it, it's worth nothing in any case. Whereas if one would adopt a more qualitative relationship to the Ribbono Shel Olam, sure, one needs to look after the future and within reason. But if one would use emunah to remove the anxiety rather than investment, anxiety would genuinely be moved, and retirement would probably be more pleasant as well. But there we can't yet speak from experience. The third point is the point of excitement. And the point of excitement is the same. The boring thing about the life in which we live and always have lived is that 90% of what we do is the same day after day. You have to sleep a certain number of hours a day, and you have to have meals, and you have to go to work, and you have to do that every day. And you find that at the end of the day, you've got your shiurim and you've got your davening. At the end of the day, there might be half an hour or an hour of leisure time that you can really do what you want. Now, how can that keep a day exciting? What excitement can there be if today is exactly the same as yesterday, except that I've got half an hour to decide whether I'm going to read the Star or catch up on the Rand Daily Mail? And where's the excitement? But for the qualitative man, there is. Because the qualitative man uses the circumstances with which he's faced to experience, to do things, to be, not to have. In terms of what I have every day, one day is the same as the other. Each day I have more or less the same as I had the day before. But in terms of the way I respond to what I have, in the terms of the way I feel about what I have, in terms of the challenges that are going to come my way, even if it's just the challenge of how to utilize a spare 5 minutes, which might come in the middle of the day, that's a challenge. Are you going to let it go waste, or are you going to use it? Even if it's the challenge of relating to a beggar who walks past me or whom I walk past, even if it's the challenge of relating to a halachic problem in my business which didn't come yesterday, if it's the problem of relating to colleagues, I'm going to notice someone who's miserable today, who's a little bit depressed today, try and find out why, a bit of chesed, a bit of tzedakah, a bit of rachamim. Each day the feelings, the emotions are completely different from the day before. And as one progresses and one develops oneself, these emotions become sharper and more varied and richer, and not one day is the same as the other. One can go through the same routine in terms of circumstance, but it's not the same routine in terms of response. It's not the same routine in terms of activity, whether it's emotional activity, mental, intellectual, spiritual activity. When a man is active in his circumstances, each day is different. It's unpredictable. You just don't know what's going to come. As you walk out of your front door, you don't know what's going to hit you. Circumstances predictable. The response is not. And that's where the Torah person finds his excitement. He just, every moment is different. Every moment he's being confronted with opportunities to experience new things, even if only because he's different to what he was yesterday. One understands this a little bit when one compares sports like, for example, motorboat sailing and yacht sailing in the wind. Now, a person who's sailing in the wind is far more aware of what's going on around him. The person in the big luxury motorboat, launch, comfortable, he goes on these cruises all over the place, and he goes fishing and all sorts of things like this. He gets into his boat, and he's driving along, and he's sunbathing, and the clouds come over, so he pulls close the hatch and he goes down at the bottom, and they have coffee there, and on they go, and they fish their fish, or they don't fish their fish, and they come home at the end of the day. What do they feel good about? That they did something which not many people could do, because not many people can afford it. That's the only real enjoyment that they could have, a bit of relaxation, a bit of socializing, but what do they really have? They could have had coffee at home. Okay, it's a bit different to what they did yesterday, a little bit of excitement and so on. But the man on the yacht, he's watching the clouds. If it's going to rain, it's going to affect him. It's now vital for him to know whether it's going to rain or not. It's vital for him to know if there's going to be a change in the wind, and he's responsive to the wind, and he feels it. And it's vital for him to know if the wave formations are going to change, and he's constantly watching, because one can tell by the wave formations whether there is wind in a certain area or there isn't, and sometimes one has to deviate around a little patch where there's just no wind. And then he's got to avoid getting stuck altogether, and he's got to watch it and change directions and constantly navigate. That's a man who's got to be constantly responsive to the elements around about him. That's not the acquisitive experience. There he's getting fulfillment from what he's doing. He is sailing, and he's enjoying the sailing. And he's responsive to everything that goes to making sailing. Whereas the fellow in the motorboat has surrounded himself with a huge box that propels itself all over the place, where he's totally isolated from the elements, and it makes no difference to him whether it's raining or it's not, or it's windy or it's not, or it's sunny or it's not. It makes little difference to him altogether. So he's not responsive. So in the acquisitive society, our fulfillment has to come from competition. In the qualitative society, our fulfillment can come from responsiveness, just the different things. Not one day is the same as the one before or the one after to a yachtsman. To a man in a motorboat, every day is the same. It makes no difference. That's how it is. We live in a society also where we've protected ourselves from the elements, and we've protected ourselves from the environment to a point that we become insensitive and non-caring really about it. And Israel came out of Egypt. Don't forget they were slaves in Egypt for many years. The natural response of a slave when he's given freedom is to go overboard with materialism, to go overboard into the acquisitive society, all the things he could never get, all the things he could never afford. That would be the natural response for anybody who's been restricted. When he's given his freedom, he becomes corrupt and he goes overboard in terms of an acquisitive society. So the Ribbono Shel Olam in his wisdom decided that they needed 40 years in the desert. We see this tendency to the acquisitive society with the Egel. They couldn't handle a God to whom you can relate only by being, not by having. The only way you can experience the Ribbono Shel Olam is when you're doing something. Because the Ribbono Shel Olam is a qualitative being. He's not a quantitative being. He's not a material being. So you can't see him, you can't hear him, you can't feel him. How do you relate to him? How do you feel him? By doing, you're able to feel a godly quality. When you're active in the qualitative field, you're able to experience it. They couldn't handle that. They needed something they could touch and look at and feel. They had problems. Again, with the inability to handle the going into Eretz Yisrael, the 12 spies, which we had only a couple of weeks ago, where the problem was that they were unable to see the conquest of Eretz Yisrael as a battle between people, as an interrelationship, where the conviction of their enemy, where the self-confidence of the enemy was far more important than the arsenal that they had. They saw it as an object that had to be acquired, and the object was too expensive. That's how they saw it. They didn't realize that this isn't an object that has to be required. This is a relationship that has to be indulged in. This is a relationship that has to be handled. And what's important is belief in yourself and confidence in yourself and conviction in your values. And the one who has the greater conviction is the one who will win. That they couldn't handle. And so the Ribbono Shel Olam kept them in the desert for 40 years. The concept of the desert, of the Midbar, is a place where it doesn't help having possessions. They were wealthy. Many of them came out with lots of gold and silver, which they had taken from the Egyptian neighbors, you'll remember. So they had a fortune of material and a fortune of wealth, but what can you do with it? Can't eat it. Nothing grows in the desert. So they were completely isolated. So the Ribbono Shel Olam gave them more. Now you're in trouble. You need food. How is the Ribbono Shel Olam going to give them food and make sure that they don't become one little bit materialistic? You know, once you start with food, you're with money. Once you can buy food or you can trade food, then you're in the material society already. So the Ribbono Shel Olam gives them mon. And if we just look at the concept of mon very briefly, you'll see exactly what it is. This mon came down from heaven, and behold, it was covering there was a layer of dew, and on top of that there was a very fine layer of a sort of a frost-like material. And the Bnei Israel saw it. It's very, very fine stuff. It's hardly even material. It's almost spiritual, this food. It's hardly material. It's little particles. And the Bnei Israel saw it, and they said to each other, "Manu, what is it?" They couldn't give it a name. It just was so weird. It didn't seem to be something real enough to warrant a name. And Moshe says to him, this is the bread which the Rabbeinu Namas Shalom has given you to eat. And Moshe tells them to collect each man one omer per individual at home. If you have five people in the family, you go and collect five omers. One person in the family, one omer. That's it. No matter how much the appetite of the individuals are, if you have a family of big eaters or small eaters, makes no difference. One omer per person. I don't know how much an omer is, but it's not terribly much. Do you understand how much an omer is? It's not very much. And they collected some more and some less. They weren't very accurate about this omer per person. They collected a whole lot. When they came home and they measured it out, there was only an omer. Nobody was left with the if they took too little, they had an omer. If they took too much, they had an omer. Very frustrating for a businessman. And they found yet that each, they had gathered the right amount for each person to eat. Then comes the tzivu, the instruction. And Moshe says to them, Ish al yoter mimenu ad boker. Don't save up. You either eat it all or you throw it out. But don't save up for tomorrow. This is your ration for today and it's meant to be eaten today. You can't save for tomorrow. This for a Jew is very difficult. Not to save for tomorrow. What about the children? And if there's no more tomorrow, what will we do? Started saving. Vayarum tolaim vayivash, and it got wormy and it stank. Vayiftzofaleim Moshe, and Moshe got angry. And so they went day by day and they collected as much as they needed, except on Friday they found that automatically they had two omers each, and that lasted for Shabbos. On Shabbos no more came. So the Ribbono Shel Olam has given them food, but food which is non-accumulative, food which cannot be accumulated, which cannot be saved. You cannot secure your future by materialism. There's nothing you can do to be sure that you're going to have food tomorrow. You either have emunah or you don't. If you have emunah, you'll sleep tonight. If you don't have emunah, you won't. But money in the bank won't help you because you can't buy the mon, nor can you buy any other food. And mon won't help you either because it's going to be wormy by tomorrow. So you're stuck. Now either enjoy yourselves with emunah, or if you want to take the hard way out and be disbelievers, take the hard way out and don't sleep at night. But there's no way that you can experience security through materialism. So that they're put into a situation where they have to live a qualitative life if they want a normal life. And this concept is expressed very beautifully by the Vilna Gaon on Mishlei. I've brought you this posuk before and told you about it before, where the posuk in Mishlei says, Tzadik ochel l'sova nafsho, a tzadik eats and is satisfied, uvetin reshoim techsa, and the stomach of reshoim, of wicked people, is always empty. And the Vilna Gaon talks about this as being a qualitative-quantitative concept. Klomar, that means to say, shel harashoyim chaser lahem, the stomachs of wicked people are empty. Betin shekatan bitnam me'achil achilatam. One stomach is too small to eat everything one needs and would want to, really. I mean, a rosho is a person who always wants more. And if you always want more, there's a limit to how much you can hold. So you can only hold a certain amount. And the moment that starts being digested, you want more again. So you're always lacking. But a tzaddik who eats for satisfaction, a tzaddik lives by emunah. He doesn't worry about tomorrow. Sure, he's sensible, he's not reckless, but he doesn't have sleepless nights about tomorrow. He has emunah. Uvoteach b'Hashem, he trusts in God, v'lachem lo yarivet nafsho, therefore he doesn't get angry. Uvetan reshoim tafsu, but the stomach of reshoim is always empty, shehen mityarin shema lo yelahem machar lechol. Harosh is always worried, I'm not going to have food tomorrow. Ki kol ma sheyesh lahem hu me'at etzlam, whatever they've got is too little. That's what a Rosh is always. Whatever I've got is too little. Who knows what tomorrow, what's inflation going to be next year, and who knows what expenses they're going to be next year, and whatever I've got is not enough. They haven't got bitochen, and they become miserly with their food, and so their food is always lacking. We'll do the second part of the Vilna Gaon a little bit later. Now you'll understand the Rabbeinu Bechaya, which I'll read to you about, where he explains the actual nature of the complaint of the Bnei Israel. He goes on the pasuk, Ki ein lechem ve'ein mayim, yesh litmoa. There's a question, V'halo haman yored lahem b'chol yom v'yom. After all, they had mon every day. What are they complaining about? No food and water. Gam riboy ha'mayim ayah lahem. And also they had as much water as they wanted from the miracle of the rock, which has just happened. What are they talking about? No bread and no water. But this was their claim. Amru, they said, our way of living is different. Our source of bread and water is not the same as other nations. They're feeling inadequate. There's something different between them and other people, and they don't like it. Other nations, whether they're righteous, whether they're worthy of it or they're not worthy of it, nations have bread, they have food, and certainly water. But with us, all our handling and our food and our drink is this new weird way, this new weird system, which Rabbi Nishlan hasn't seen fit to adopt in his relationship with any other nation but with us. There's no day when we have enough bread for more days. It's quite a dangerous situation to be in, if you can just picture yourself. But in your wife's kitchens or your mother's kitchens, there's no food for tomorrow, and you have no idea where it's going to come from tomorrow. And you finish supper tonight, that's it, the house is now empty. If you wake up in the middle of the night and you're hungry, sad is, there's nothing. Like with other nations. Other nations are satisfied, they've got enough food. They can see their food in their hands and with them. We only have one day's ration at a time. And even water, which is hefker, it goes free in the whole world. In those days, you didn't have to pay for water. And a person can't live without water. We've had experience already when they cut off the water. Miriam died and we lost our water. It wasn't so easy and it wasn't so pleasant. Who knows when it's going to happen again? And since all our handling is dependent on punishment and reward, we have a different relationship with God than any other nation. And that's based on a Gemara in Yuma, where the Gemara says, Talmidim of Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai asked him, Rabbi Shimon doesn't like doing miracles for nothing. He is very sparing with his miracles, and he only does them when they're absolutely necessary. So why didn't he bring them on once a year and let them store it? And he could make it in such a way that it didn't get wormy overnight, and he would have it for a whole year. Here the Gemara penetrates to the very essence of what the concept of mon is. In other words, the Talmidim are asking, what is this peculiar aspect of mon that it's only one day's rations at a time and it can't last any longer? And he says to them, I'll give you an example, the Madhava Dume. And he gives the example of a king who has a son, and once a year he decides the income of the son. The son comes to see him and they fix the income for the following year. And the king suddenly realizes, this is the only time I see my son is when he comes to discuss his income with me. So I'll fix it day by day, not year by year. Then I'll see him every day. Like parents sometimes do when their sons are learning in yeshiva, they find that the only time they get a letter from their children is when they run out of money. So they send them less and less every time, so they should get more frequent letters. It's quite acceptable. So it says the Rebbeinu Shel Olam, can you imagine the Jews, he says the Gemara, says Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai, somebody who has four or five children. He was worried, or Meron used to say, in case there won't be man tomorrow, I've got five children, what are they going to eat? They'll all die bereaved in famine. The result of that was that everybody had their hearts directed to the Ribbono Shel Olam. There was no other way you could get food except from the Ribbono Shel Olam. That was clear in their minds. Comes out that they knew how to behave themselves and they knew how to operate. And the Ribbono Shel Olam wanted to teach us forever and ever how to relate to matters of parnasa, how to relate to the concept of earning a living. But it comes from the Ribbono Shel Olam. And no matter how much you've got or you haven't got, you never know what will be tomorrow. And that's just how it is. And tomorrow depends on your quality, the quality of your life. It doesn't depend on the quantity of your life. The world is learning that now, with inflation and with oil and all that. The quantity is not limitless. It's quality which is important. So now one understands the claim of the Bnei Yisrael. What the Bnei Yisrael are saying is, they have a problem. Their problem is they're not spiritually fulfilled. And therefore they need quantitative fulfillment. They've come to a point where their fulfillment can't be gotten out of the mon. They need to feel that there's a tomorrow, they need to feel that there's a future, they need to feel there's a worthwhileness in their lives. And they're not getting it out of their Yiddishkeit, they're not getting it out of their Torah and out of their Jewishness at this moment. Don't forget, the last little while has been pretty rough. There have been a couple of wars, they've been refused entries into certain countries, Aaron has died, they lost their water once, there's been Machlokes, there's been Korach. It's been a pretty turbulent period for them, and one can understand, apart from anything else, that it's not that easy under such circumstances to retain one's level of spiritual fulfillment. When one's experiencing difficulties with one's spiritual fulfillment, one automatically turns to compensation, and the compensation is material fulfillment. Imagine for a moment, we'll come now to the other avera that they committed, that graphically will represent quantitative values as a horizontal line and qualitative values as a vertical line. In that case, graphically again, the human being would be the representative of the being who is most capable of achieving a qualitative life, because he's the only one who stands upright. The concept of a vertical being, of a vertical body, which is part of our uniqueness in human beings, is a demonstration of our ability to stand upright. We can develop stature, we can develop height and value. An animal is horizontal. But the most horizontal of all the animals, and the one who has no vertical value whatever, and no stature whatever, is the snake. It's just a straight vertical line parallel to the earth. He has no shir koma, he has no stature whatever. What does a snake do when he feels threatened? He bites you at your ankle, and you fall down, and you're like him. Then he can handle you. When you're lying down in pain, don't know what to do with yourself, and you're flat on the ground, then he goes off. He's not worried about you anymore. He knows. While the human being's on his 2 feet, that's a threat. Once he's laid out flat, it's all right. So he creeps up behind you when you're not looking. He won't face you head on. He won't challenge you to a fight. He'll creep out of the grass, and he'll bite your ankle, and you'll fall down, and you're flat like him. The Nachash, as we know, represents the snake, represents the Yetzer Hara. Right from the beginning of the Torah, some people say it's the first story of the Nachash is totally allegorical and it represents the Yetzer Hara. Some say it's not totally allegorical, it doesn't matter. But certainly the snake is representative of the Yetzer Hara. The Yetzer Hara is that drive in a man for more. And the Ribbono Shel'olam gave us a Yetzer Hara because without that we wouldn't eat and we wouldn't sleep and we wouldn't go to business, we wouldn't do anything, we wouldn't turn a page of Gemara. We would just sit and learn the one pasuk of Torah all day. We would have no drive to go further, horizontally. We would have no drive to go any further, quantitatively. And we need to move quantitatively also, both in spiritual areas and in physical areas. There's a need to make quantitative progress as well. So we need a Yetzer Hara. And that Yetzer Hara is represented by the snake. What's important, though, is that our fulfillment doesn't come from our horizontal movement. Our fulfillment has to come from vertical movement. When the snake is threatened, the snake bites at the ankle. And the bite of the snake is always referred to in Midrashic literature as the bite of the person of the Medabe Loshon Hora, of the person who talks Loshon Hora. And we say that the same as a person who talks slander gets nothing out of it, he gets no benefit out of it, so the snake gets no benefit out of biting. Other animals eat when they're hungry, they bite when they're hungry, they attack when they're hungry. The snake attacks when he feels threatened. A lion doesn't attack when he feels threatened. He looks you straight in the face and gives a roar and you run. He attacks when he's hungry, not the snake. He goes for your ankle and pulls you down to his level. It is an intrinsic part of the quantitative existence that Loshon Hora must result. Now what does the snake represent? Does he represent Loshon Hora or does he represent the Yetzer Hora? It's the same thing. A quantitative life, a life based on the Yetzer Hora, a life that where fulfillment is sought in quantitative areas, must lead to Loshon Hora. Why? What does a snake do when he's attacked? He brings you down to his level. What does a person who needs quantitative fulfillment do when he's not achieving that quantitative fulfillment? He spent 50 years of his life working, and either he's lost his money or he never made any money. How does he justify that? If you think Harry Oppenheimer is rich, I know how he got his money. A ganav. That's what he does. Starts with his Loshon Hora. He brings everybody who's bigger than him down to size. That's what he's got to do, because he hasn't made it. So he brings everybody else down to a little bit below his size, and now he feels good again. He's a snake. Not the qualitative person. Because the moment the qualitative person would say such a thing, he would feel an emptiness inside him. He would feel a miserableness inside him. He's out for quality, and to talk Loshon Hora is the antithesis of the quality he's seeking. And it's not shaykh, it doesn't apply to a qualitative person that is unsuccessful. What does it mean that he's unsuccessful? That he didn't make any money? That won't bother him so much. So he didn't make money. But he's a good person. So you say, but he's not a good person maybe? Maybe he's dissatisfied with his past. Ah, but a qualitative person can even change his past. That's what tshuva does. He can do tshuva, and we learn that with tshuva, not only can you change your future, but you can retroactively change your past. That's how a qualitative person operates. He thinks to himself, oh, you're 50 years and I've done nothing with myself. So he sits down and he does tshuva and he feels better and it's all over. The qualitative person can't rectify his past. He can't make all the money he set out to make over the last 50 years. He can't acquire all the objects and all the properties and all the things that he wanted to acquire. He can't now acquire that he's in his 50s or his 60s. It's too late. And he feels a failure. There's only one thing for him to do. Cut everybody else down to size. They're not really that successful. Here we've got Am Yisrael. Two things they do. The first is they complain about the mon. Why? Mon you can only relate to qualitatively. It doesn't fill your tummy. You don't feel full. That's the one problem with mon that Chazal tell us. That when you finish, and that's how they explain the word kolokel, that when you finished a meal of mon, you don't feel full at all. But you've got all the energy you need, and you've got all the proteins and whatever else it is that you need, and it could taste magnificent. If you're related to the mon correctly, and if you put the right intentions into the eating of the mon, it tasted magnificent. So you had everything you need from food, except the quantity. The one thing you didn't get from mon, enjoyment of it, richness of food, flavor, smell, everything. Energy, vitamins, the lot. Just not quantity. And that's the one thing they're complaining about. Why? They're not spiritually fulfilled. And the need is now for quantitative fulfillment. They want to hold their food. They want to be able to save it up. They want to collect. They want to build up fortunes. They want to go into Eretz Yisrael already and live like the other nations. And part of that must then extend into blaming somebody for their failure. They've got to say, bring us into a desert. What do you expect? In Egypt, at least we had something. Of course we're failures. Of course we've got nothing. You, Moshe, and you, the Ribbono Shel Olam, brought us into this. It's not our fault. There you've got it. It's the spiritual inadequacy which has to lead to Lashon Hara. Whenever you find Lashon Hara, no matter who it comes from, you must know that there's spiritual inadequacy. You must know that the person speaking it feels inadequate, feels a failure, and he's a failure in an area of spiritual fulfillment, and it's necessary for him, in order to feel important enough, to bring everybody else down to size. So the Ribbono Shel Olam sends the snake in, and now we understand the Rashi. The Rashi says the following: Vayenashchu et ha'am, and the snake bit the people. Yavo nachash shelakal hotzati ba. This is a big chiddush in Rashi. Why was the snake punished in Bereishis? What did he do wrong? We always learn because he enticed Eve into eating of that famous fruit. It's not true. How can an animal be blamed for enticing a human being? Who's got more seichel? Eve or the snake? So Eve should have refused the advances of the snake. How can the snake be blamed for it? Says Rashi, he's not blamed for enticing Eve. He's blamed for talking Lashon Hara. And you remember when Eve said to the snake, I can't eat that, the Ribbono Shel Olam said no. He said, you don't understand why the Ribbono Shel Olam said no. He's afraid you'll be as great as him. He doesn't like competition, the Ribbono Shel Olam. And he knows that if you eat the fruit, you'll be creative. And he doesn't want you to be creative. That's Lashon Hara. And for that he's punished. So says Rashi, why did God send in the snakes? Because the first being, the first creature ever to talk Lashon Hara was our friend the snake. Of course, the horizontal guy, the quantitative guy, the Yetzer Hara. It's inevitable that he'll be the first to fall into the trap of Lashon Hara. And he's the guy who comes and bites them. The Yiflom Emotze Dibo. And he comes and he takes payment from those who talk Lashon Hara. That's for the Aveira of the Lashon Hara. What about the Aveira of talking badly about the mom? Says Rashi, Yavo Nachash Shekol Haminim Litamim Lo Tam Echad. Part of the curse of the Nachash, part of the curse of the snake, was that whatever he eats will have no taste. It will taste like dust. It's all tasteless. That means the snake is the one creature that gets no qualitative fulfillment whatever from food. Other animals at least get some taste from it. They get something nice. It's the gravy or whatever it is, but there's something that makes it different. It makes it pleasant for them. But as far as the snake is concerned, no gravy will help and no vitagen will help. Nothing will help. Everything he eats tastes like dust. Says the Rashi, okay, what's your problem with Amon? You can't relate to it spiritually. You need the quantitative. Would you rather have it like the snake? Here's the guy who gets only physical fulfillment from his food. He only gets a quantitative fulfillment from his food. He, by his very nature, he must be a malshin. He must be a person who talks Lashon Hara. and he's the guy who's going to come and eat you. And that's exactly what he does. Sends in the snakes, and the snakes start biting. Now, lastly, we've got to know, so what's the cure? Okay, they come and they say to the Ribbono Shel Olam, sorry, we understand it's Lashon Hara. Immediately they understood. Snake, Lashon Hara. Says the Ribbono Shel Olam, make the snake and stick it on a pole, and they look at it, it'll be alright. Says Rashi, don't think that it's the snake which fixes them up. It's the fact that they're looking upwards to the Ribbono Shel Olam. So we ask them, what do you need the snake for? This is a little bit difficult, but I think that you'll follow it quite easily. The Ribbono Shel Olam tells them, how do you handle a snake? Don't forget, we're talking on two levels. We're talking about a physical snake who's really biting them, and we're talking about a spiritual snake inside each one of them. And both have to be gotten rid of. When the inside snake is gone, the outside snake will be gone, and he won't take away the outside snake until the inside snake is gone. So the mechanism of looking at the snake on the pole is obviously a way of getting rid of the inside snake, of getting rid of this quantitative drive. Right? The snake is the expression of the horizontal, of the quantitative drive of man, the man to cover more ground. That's what has to be gotten rid of. That's not the area of fulfillment. Says the Ribbono Shel Olam, as long as a man looks at the snake biting him, at the snake at his feet, he feels threatened by the snake. And when you feel threatened, your thinking is altogether irrational. You say things that you don't want to say. You do things that you don't want to do. You respond in a way which is not natural and normal. See the difference between inhibited people when they're talking and playing with kids and when they're talking and playing with adults. And there's a stiffness and a formality when they're talking and relating to adults, and there's a complete freeness and ease when they're relating to children. That's natural. They don't feel threatened by children, so they can relate and relax and be themselves. When it comes to adults, they're on their guard immediately. Watching a snake, you're on your guard. Says the Ribbono Shel Olam, you'll never beat the snake in his own territory. Because you're on your guard and you feel threatened and you'll do all sorts of things, that's not the way you'll get rid of him. Take that snake and conceptualize him. Turn him into a concept. Just know that everything is a concept after all. Take the snake and analyze. What is he really? Why is he here? Why did he come here? Why is he biting me? What did I do wrong? Understand what a snake means. Understand the horizontal aspect of a snake. Study your internal snake. Get to know your snake a little bit better. Just get to know that Yetzer Hara inside you a little bit better. Study him. But to study him, it's got to be as a concept. So Moshe, he says, make an artificial snake so that they won't feel threatened by the snake. And stick it on a pole. The purpose of sticking it on the pole is that they can see that snake in the background of the heavens. That's it. Number one, first point, is to make it abstract, to make it unreal, artificial. That there's no feeling of threat. So now you can analyze it coldly. You can look at it and say, snake, what is a snake? And you don't have to be on your guard. You can face it squarely and analyze it honestly. But where do you analyze it? In relationship to the Ribbono Shel Olam. Don't analyze it down on the ground. Take it up to the heavens and have a look at it there. Which is what the Gemara means when the Gemara says, Impogo b'chom menuvel zeh, if the Yetzer Hara gets hold of you, if that snake gets hold of you, that drive for quantitative ambition becomes so great that you're about to do something wrong for it, a bit of dishonesty, a little lie, a bit of Lashon Hara, whatever it is, something to satisfy that quantitative need, Moshchei the Beis HaMidrash, take him into the Beis HaMidrash. So you're about to do something, you're not really sure whether what you want to do in business this afternoon is really right or it isn't. You can justify it, and it'll give you a fortune, and you're going to make a million. It's not really a lie. It's not quite honest. And you get yourself into total confusion. Says the Gemara, you're never going to sort it out over there. You're in his area. You're in the Nachash's area. You're in the snake's area. Take the snake into the Beis HaMidrash and sit and have a chat with him there. You go into that Beis HaMidrash and make your artificial snake. Don't talk about your immediate business problem. That's the real snake. Just keep away from him because he'll beat you. Talk about a theoretical snake. Make a theoretical problem and have a look at Halacha. Learn the sugya of Sheker. Go through the Pesukim, through the Torah where it deals with lying and with dishonesty. Learn through the Rashi and the Ramban and the Sipurna. Nothing that touches or affects you. Just learn it objectively. And go through the Gemaras that deal with it and the Gemaras that talk about where you can lie and where you can't lie and under what circumstances you can lie. And go through the Poskim and work it out until you've analyzed the concept of honesty and lying. Your snake will be beaten. You'll have no problem when you come out to face him because you're taking him into your area of strength. That's the human being's area of strength, the Beis HaMidrash, the intellectual analytical area. That's where you can beat anybody because you can take it and analyze and look at it squarely. But when you're looking at it emotionally, when you feel threatened and you feel scared and your immediate business is just to get rid of him, then you're not looking at it rationally and you can't master it. And one has to know that before we carry on, and with that we'll conclude, it's not the nachash, and it's not just looking up at heaven. It's not just looking at the sky that's going to cure them, and it's not just looking at the snake. It's looking at the snake in the context of heaven. Then you'll understand what a snake is, and you'll understand what Lashon Hora is, and you'll understand what a quantitative drive is, and you'll understand what led you to it, and you'll understand why that snake's over there. Then you'll be able to do tshuva. Then you'll be able to regret it and uproot it from yourselves, and then I'll take the snake away. And one has to understand that this quantitative drive is not just something which exists in the secular world, and that if one's religious, one is free from it. Not at all. The quantitative drive is as much a problem, if not more, inside the religious world as it is outside of the religious world. And Mr. Vilna Gaon says in that same piece that I gave you a few moments ago. Thanks. Now he goes on and he says, "Vechein b'Torah," and the same principle applies in Torah. "Tzaddik oichel l'soiva." What does it mean that a righteous person eats with satisfaction? "Shelomed b'chdei sheyehei saveya." When he's learning, what's his motivation? What's his aim? When's he going to leave off the sugya? When's he going to move on to the next sugya? "He's lomed b'chdei sheyehei saveya." He learns in order to feel good. He wants satisfaction. He wants it to sit nicely. He wants to feel good after his learning. And he doesn't even notice if he's covered a lot of ground or a little ground. It doesn't make any difference at all. Stress again, we're not talking about the mitzvah of Yediyas HaTorah, of knowing the whole Torah, which is a different thing altogether. We're talking about the mitzvah of learning Torah, which is the kind of thing that Chazon Ish was talking about this afternoon. He says he learns in order to be happy, to enjoy it, to feel good. He doesn't notice if it's a lot or a little. Rakshi Yehei Yodea Al Borya. The condition is that he should know it with absolute clarity. Alborio means in its totality. Not only does he know the various aspects of it, but he knows it in its totality. The yispa nafsho and the yikayim. And his soul will feel satisfied and he'll feel alive. That's what he wants. And he won't leave a sugya until he's got that satisfaction. Ach betin reshoyim techsa, but what about these wicked people? They want to show off how much they know. They want to know more than the guy next to them. That's quantitative. It happens to be in Torah. It happens to be in learning. But that's quantitative. They run around to a million different shirim to learn as much as they can, and they go to a Gemara shirim, and a Chumash shirim, and a Mishnah shirim, and to three Gemara shirim, and to more and more, so they can say, "I go to 15 shirim a week." And they gather up a lot in one moment. It's humanly impossible to digest so much. He's taking more than he can digest. Through that, their stomach's always going to be empty, because they'll never have fulfillment. If you're eating and you're not digesting, it doesn't help. The result of that is that there'll be nothing that stays with them. Go around and cover a lot of ground, but what will be left of them? Nothing at all, says the Vilna Gaon. They are ashamed. Although they're frum, and they're learning a fortune, the quality of the learning which is important, the quality of the learning which is going to affect you ultimately, it's not the quantity. One has to know, but it's not the quantity which is going to give fulfillment. One has to cover ground, but it's not the covering ground which gives fulfillment. One has to know the dinim, but it's not knowledge of the dinim which is going to make you feel good and is going to introduce spirituality in your life. And so one has to know that when one hears anything, or one reads anything, or one learns anything, if one wants to value or evaluate something, which is something we have to do all the time. We have to evaluate people. Not judge them. We're not here to judge people. But to evaluate them, yes. I'm not here to judge whether so-and-so is a tzaddik or a rosh. That's not my business. I'm here to judge his actions. I can say that his actions are right or they're wrong, but I can't say that he's a tzaddik or a rosh because I don't know him well enough. I don't know anybody well enough to say that. But I must evaluate him. Is he the kind of person I want to get closer to or keep away from? We had this afternoon. There's some people you've got to move out of the suburb. There's some people you've got to cling to. So I've got to evaluate people. I can't go around naively thinking that everybody's wonderful. I've got to know there are some people, maybe everybody's tzaddik, and maybe they're not, I don't know. All I know is there's some people I've got to be attracted to, and there's some people I've got to keep away from. There's some people I've got to give more time to, and some people I've got to give less time to. There's some people I must give no time to. There's some people I must give all time to. There's a list of priorities. Who comes first? Who comes second? Two people come at the same time and they need something from me. What is the type of person that I would go for first? Who will get the preference? All this has to be worked in terms of evaluation. Even more important than in human relations is in concepts. We're living in a time where we're battered with information. All the time, the newspapers, the magazines, the books we read, the shiurim we hear, the lectures we hear, the stories we hear, the things we're told, television, radio. In this country, it's still less than in countries overseas, constantly being bombarded with information and cliches and principles and statements of fact. This is how it is, and this is how it's got to be, and this is right, and this is wrong. Sometimes it's from outside the Torah circle, and sometimes it's from inside the Torah circle. And sometimes from in the Torah circle, you'll be told one thing one day, and you'll be told something opposite the next day by somebody else. Both equally authoritatively, both equally excluding the other one. What do? You've got to be able to evaluate. We have here the method of evaluation. The method of evaluation is, don't be fearful if what you're hearing is a threat. One of the big problems in honest evaluation is that what you're hearing appears to contradict something you already believe. Maybe even something you've based your entire life on. It's very difficult. For a man, it becomes more and more difficult as one gets older to hear something which is contrary to what one's believed all one's life, to an approach one's followed all one's life. So one's immediate feeling is one of defense. One feels threatened. The snake. That's not honest. That's not stature. You're worried about quantity. One gets scared and one reacts in a threatened sort of way, and it's not an objective and an honest way of analyzing. And the second is one sometimes becomes overwhelmed and overawed at the quantitative impressiveness of the statement that's made, the authority with which it's made, the number of quotes which are brought to bolster it up. In the secular world, everything is based on quotes. The more footnotes you've got at the bottom of your thesis, the more authoritative it is. Nobody even bothers to check whether you understood the footnotes properly. That's not important. The footnotes must be there, and they must be more or less quoted correctly. Whether you've really understood them or not, who's got the time to check up? Who can possibly know? I only realize this because I've seen doctorates that have been written in my field, in Jewish studies. And I see the rubbish that people write in their footnotes. They quote a Gemara, they quote a Chazal, and they draw out a conclusion from it that is absolutely contrary to what the Gemara is saying. And they've got their doctors on it with flying colors. So I can imagine if that happens in Jewish studies, it happens all over. And I can understand, nobody has the time to go and check every footnote and learn through every sugya that the guy has quoted and make sure that he's understood it correctly. Who's got the time for such a thing? But the footnotes are impressive. And so it is within Torah as well. If you can throw in that the Rambam says so, and that the Shulchan Aruch says so, and that there's a Gemara somewhere.